Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, flush from the victories in the Spanish-American War, the U.S. Navy found itself, along with the nation it serves, steaming into the 20th century, energized and with a new set of energy. And when you use those two descriptions, you really have a personality come to the front who shared those same types of characteristics. And perhaps one could say that the dominant figure of the first decade of the 20th century is Theodore Roosevelt. Is it a fair assumption, and how important was he to the continued emergence of the U.S. Navy after its victory in the Spanish-American War?
Well, I think it's important to start with a conversation about Teddy Roosevelt. You're absolutely correct about the first decade of the 20th century. You know, there are historians who have suggested, and I think correctly, that the 20th century becomes the American century. Here, the United States has just fought an overseas war with a European power, won it overwhelmingly and handily in a short period of time. Its new fleet is evident to the rest of the world, and here comes a new, young, energetic is the word you used, I think that's correct, president who has been a Navy man really all his life, eager to make the United States a dominant, if not the dominant, power in the world. And so as we embark on the 20th century, Theodore Roosevelt is, I think, a absolutely central figure. And he certainly fits into the theme that we've been discussing, which is the writer warriors, because he was clearly both. I mean, a warrior, obviously, most people are aware of his role in the Spanish-American War. The charge up what he liked to refer to as San Juan Hill, actually Kettle Hill, in the war in Cuba, what he called his crowded hour, which he cherished all his life as his most profound military experience. But fewer people are aware, I think, of what a productive writer he was. He published his first book when he was still in his 20s, his Harvard University master's thesis on the War of 1812, became a book that is, believe it or not, still in print today and still a pretty good read. But he also wrote books on the winning of the West, on his adventures hunting in the high country in the West, and about naval and military topics around the world. Dozens, even scores of articles, and he got paid for them. He was, much like someone who was very nearly his contemporary, Winston Churchill, a man who made a living with his pen. So he was very much the quintessential warrior writer and emerged as much by accident as by planning as the youngest president in the history of the United States after the assassination of William McKinley in 1901. And you asked about how important he was. You know, no single individual drives the course of history, but he comes pretty close. He seemed to grab history by the throat and just shake it and send it in the direction he wanted to go. And during his nearly two full terms as president, he expanded the Navy enormously. I think the more than a dozen new battleships were authorized with his urging. Six of them in 1905 alone, six battleships authorized in a single year. It never happened in the history of the United States before. He's famous, of course, for the Great White Fleet, and we can talk about that expedition. And altogether, a new kind of activist policy for the United States and the world.
And we have there a young president at the dawn of what would later be called the progressive era, and that really has the background of the personalities and the attitudes of the first decade of the 20th century. What was happening over on the naval technology side of the equation this era? Was the United States finally starting to keep pace and work at the same level the European navies were?
Yes, very much so. And technology continues to change. This is a period of dramatic technological change, not unlike our own, I suppose, and particularly in naval matters. You know, the change in the 19th century from sail to steam, from smoothbore cannon to rifled ordnance shells is mirrored and, in fact, is expanded upon dramatically in this first decade of the 20th century by the modifications made to battleships. Battleships were perceived, thanks again largely to Alfred Thayer Mahan, whom we talked about last time in our discussion of the 1890s, largely because of Mahan, battleships were considered the absolute measuring stick, not only of naval greatness, but even of national greatness. And the important thing was then to have a dominant battleship fleet on the high seas. The problem for nations that had invested heavily in battleships is that the technology for those was changing as well, and in two important ways, or a lot of minor ways, but I'm going to mention two that were crucial. One is ordnance. That is, what kind of guns did they carry? Most of the time, in the early years of the 20th century, and certainly throughout the 19th century, battleships had what was known as a mixed battery. They'd have a couple of big guns, maybe four, and then six middle-sized guns, and then 12 small guns, and then 20 very small guns for close-in defense. And the idea was that this mixed battery could respond to a variety of threats. But the biggest guns, of course, had the longest range, and it didn't take much thinking about it to realize, you know, if you've only got two long-range guns, or maybe four, at the very beginning of the battle, those are the only ones that are going to be useful. What if we increase the number of the biggest guns and get rid of some of the smaller guns so that we'll have a dominant position during the early minutes of the battle? They'll never get close enough to use their smaller guns. And the appreciation of this came into effect in this decade. In fact, in 1905, the United States built the USS New Hampshire, one of those new battleships in this decade, and it carried four 12-inch guns. But the very next year, it authorized two more, the South Carolina and the Michigan, and they were going to have eight 12-inch guns. So here the realization has already occurred to American designers and American policymakers that if you've got more big guns, even if you lose some of the smaller guns, you are in a more dominant position. Well, other people were figuring this out too, and particularly the first Sea Lord in Britain, Jacky Fisher, who in 1906, notice this is about the same time as the United States, in 1906 authorized the construction of HMS Dreadnought. The difference was that Fisher pushed its construction as fast as he could, so the Dreadnought was actually launched in only 10 months, a remarkable short period of time. So the Dreadnought is the first battleship on the high seas of any nation that has almost all big guns. In fact, it has 10 12-inch guns, the largest guns then afloat. And because of that, in the ensuing decade, and several decades in fact, all battleships were categorized as either pre-dreadnought or dreadnought. And if they were dreadnought ships, that meant they had twice the power at the greatest range. The United States did finally launch dreadnoughts of its own, but not until 1910, not because we didn't think of it until then, but because it took us longer to complete those ships. So ordnance is one big change. The emergence of these all-big gun battleships is the new measuring stick for naval greatness. And the other one is the shift from coal as the principal fuel for the battle fleet to oil. This is dramatically important. Oil gives battleships greater speed, greater maneuverability. The difficulty for the British was they didn't have any oil. So they knew they needed to build oil-fired ships to be competitive, and they knew they needed to find some way to get oil from overseas, and so they formed the Anglo-Persian Oil Company and began sending their business and diplomatic tentacles into the Middle East, which, as we all know, would have enormous consequences down the road. For the United States, the shift from coal to oil was a piece of cake. We were already the world's largest producer of petroleum crude. This was before the drilling of the vast Spindletop oil fields in East Texas. So the United States is the world's biggest oil producer. The shift to oil, relatively easy to do, gave our ships a lot more speed and a lot more maneuverability. So those are the two big things, I think, in naval development. The new big, all-big gun battleship, the dreadnought type, and the use of oil as the fuel.
Let's talk a bit about the world power balance, who the big players were on the global scene. Is this the stage that the U.S. began to become acknowledged as one of the big players in world politics? And what other power changes did we start to see amongst the powers?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is true. The United States now, we could argue that it emerges in the late 1890s with the Spanish-American War, but the recognition of that emergence takes place in the first decade of the 20th century. The great powers of Europe, traditionally, of course, Britain and France, and now, increasingly, Germany, recognize the United States as a player. Japan, too, in this same period, begins to emerge as a major naval power in its own right. So there are kind of five great naval powers keeping a wary eye on one another as players in this great power politics game. The big naval rivalry in the world in this decade, though, is between the British and the Germans. The Germans, of course, up to this point, had been almost exclusively a land power. The unification of Germany in the 1870s, their concern about the military powers on both of their borders, Russia to the east, France to the west, meant they focused their attention on armies. But now, beginning in the 20th century, they begin to think navally as well, and they begin to build dreadnoughts. And in fact, one of the great ironies of this is that the construction and launch of the dreadnought gave them their chance, because now, with a new standard, they have a chance to get in the game by building dreadnoughts and kind of keep pace with Britain. For Britain, that's absolutely unacceptable. Britain knows its very survival depends on having naval supremacy in battleships in particular. So they adopt a policy of outbuilding Germany, outbuilding the rest of the world, in fact, two for one. For every one battleship anybody else has, we're going to build two. Well, this creates an enormous naval arms race, and it makes the Germans nervous about the British. It makes the British nervous about the Germans, so nervous, in fact, that the British throw off their traditional suspicion and enmity of France and actually sign an alliance with the French, absolutely unheard of, an earth-shaking development. And that's the beginning of what will emerge as the alliance system that contributes to the cataclysm of World War I in the next decade. So I think it's fair to argue that the building race, particularly between Britain and Germany, but among the five great powers generally, contributes to a sense of suspicion and hostility that contributes to the development of an alliance system that divides Europe into two parties.
We talked about it briefly at the beginning of our conversation, Craig, and it's funny, and now and then you'll read somebody who will kind of dismiss it like, well, the minute it got underway, it was already obsolete, but I really think they missed the point of it. It really is a touchstone, a pivot point, a reference point in the rise of America, and like you mentioned before, you know, the American century, when it emerged, and that was the Great White Fleet's tour around the world. What was Roosevelt's purpose in putting the Great White Fleet together and sending it around the world?
Well, he's got a couple of purposes in mind. One is political. Roosevelt is a political animal, and he wants to demonstrate to his skeptical Congress that the money he's been asking them to spend is worth it. There's going to be some benefit here. He wants to make sure the fleet gets over to the West Coast, where those senators and congressmen can see it so that they can make port visits, and people will have parades and wave flags and make a lot of headlines up and down both coasts. So there's a political element to that. There's also a diplomatic element to this. He wants to see what the reaction is of the rest of the world to this fleet, 16 battleships with several accompanying consorts, painted white. Traditionally, that's the peacetime color, as it makes supposedly goodwill visits across the Pacific, Australia, Japan, of course, into the Indian Ocean, and then finally up to Europe and back to the United States again. So there's a diplomatic element here. And I think he did have Japan particularly in mind. You know, look at this, you emerging Japanese navalists. We have a fleet, too. And then finally, there's a technological element here. He wanted to see if these seagoing battleships could, in fact, function hundreds, even thousands of miles away from a friendly port. Up until now, up until the first decade of the 20th century, most of our battleships had been considered defensive weapons to defend the coast. But Roosevelt can see that it's likely, particularly if Mahan's theories are correct, that they may have to fight battles quite distant from our coast. Could they do that? Could they get to mid-Pacific? Could they have what we now call UNREP, underway replenishment? Most these ships are all still coal burners. They're the older ones, the new oil-fired ships, not yet having joined the fleet. This is 1907 to 1909 this takes place. And the Michigan, the first American dreadnought, is commissioned in 1910. So these are coal burners, but they still have to be refueled at sea and at distant ports. So he wanted to find out if that was possible. So for political, diplomatic, and for technological reasons, he thought it was a good idea.
Also, one of the touchstone parts of this era is the U.S. began to construct the Panama Canal. How important was that to the U.S. Navy as it continued to build and expand and operate in the early 20th century?
Well, it's absolutely huge. I mean, one of the United States, in geopolitical terms, is an island. It has an Atlantic Ocean and Pacific Ocean. It has friendly neighbors on both sides, Canada and Mexico. And yes, we did fight a war with Mexico in the middle of the 19th century, but generally speaking, that has not been an existential threat to United States security. So having two coasts like that, if Mahan is right, and you really need to keep your battleship fleet intact, as what he called a fleet in being, then you've got a problem, because you either have to divide your fleet into Atlantic and Pacific fleets, which Mahan said was a very bad idea, or find some way for them to get from one coast to the other relatively quickly. And, of course, there was no way to do that until the Panama Canal. This was brought home in a particularly dramatic way during the Spanish-American War, when the battleship Oregon, then visiting its namesake state on the west coast, was sent back to the east coast to join in the campaign against Cuba. Well, it had to go all the way down around the southern tip of South America to do it, and taking months. And it brought home the fact that having fleet divided on two separate coasts was a problem. So even though the idea of a Panama Canal was very old, all the way back to the earliest explorers, the urgency to get it done seemed to emerge in the first decade of the 20th century. And Theodore Roosevelt, being Theodore Roosevelt, figured he could get this done. The French had actually started a canal. There was a company, a private French company under a fellow named de Lesseps. The guy who had built the Suez Canal, in fact, said, I can build a canal through Panama. And he got to work on it. He had investors. He had equipment. He had started it, but they went bankrupt. And Roosevelt said, well, we'll just take over from the French. We'll buy out the company. We'll get the same deal from Colombia that they had, Colombia then being a nation with sovereignty over Panama, and we'll just finish it up. But having signed a treaty with Colombia, the Colombian Senate refused to ratify it. They wanted more money, not an unreasonable demand, by the way. Well, Roosevelt wouldn't hear that. And besides that, the French company, the stockholders, they stood to lose money if they couldn't sell their interest to the United States. So they kind of fomented a revolution in Panama, which declared its independence, by the way, in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. And the United States made a deal with this new breakaway government, accepting the original terms of the French treaty and thereby gained the Panama Canal Zone to build the canal. It's a kind of a measure of the bull in a china shop kind of diplomacy that Theodore Roosevelt tended to carry off. It did get the job done. Of course, it created resentments in Latin America against the United States that lasted for four decades until his distant cousin Franklin Roosevelt instituted the Good Neighbor Policy. So it had a high cost, but it got done. And it opened in 1914, just as World War I was breaking out. So that ability now to transfer warships from one coast to the other through the Panama Canal allowed the United States to have both a large fleet and a unified fleet.
And Craig, with that, we wind up the first decade of the 20th century and look forward to our next episode where we're going to hit, you talk about a tremendous decade for the navalist, the decade that included the First World War, the 1910s.
Okay.
Claude, at the opening of the American century in the first decade of the 1900s, what writers do we find being real active in the Navy side of the intellectual discussion?
I think we see during this particular decade, 1900 to 1910, the role of the insurgents, people like Philip Rounsville Alger, a Bostonian who had been first in his class at the Naval Academy in 1880. He goes on to become, after some time serving in the Navy, goes on to become a math instructor at the Academy and later head of the Department of Mechanics, and also serves as Secretary Treasurer of Naval Institute. You have Homer Poundstone from West Virginia, who is strongly backed by William Sims, who is, like Alger, writing about the all-big-gun ship. These and others are the proponents of this new generation of warship. This is the generation that got their chops overseas, with whether it was Manila Bay or closer to home at Battle of Santiago. And it's important to note that the Spanish-American War changes the Navy in one significant way. From 1873, when the Naval Institute is founded, until the Spanish Civil War, the Spanish-American War, the officers are identifying and articulating the role of the Navy with regard to the country in its continuing battle against the Army. In terms of resources, resources that were largely devoted to the Army in its westward expansion, and finds its really its culmination at the end of the century. The role of the Navy then in these writers, and I would add also Lloyd Chandler, Naval Academy class of 1888, who eventually becomes the 34th Commandant of Midshipmen, and others like Asa Walker, who was Academy class of 1886. He had been commander of the USS Concord, off of Mobile Bay, and a four-time instructor at the Naval Academy. With the Spanish-American War, they find two things. Number one, it's the culmination of their dreams, if you will, and expectations and theories about the role of the Navy. It's truly the Mahanian era at this point. The second is that it is not only inward-looking, it is now outward-looking. And I want to relate that to the 1830s again. I previously mentioned in earlier podcast the role of the junior officers in the 1830s as they're exploring the world. In peacetime operations, they are in squadrons all around the world and going on land. Touring the areas, whether it is what is known as Syria, Israel, in today's terms, or South America, or the Pacific. They're exploring the world around them and identifying the Navy and its role in the country and its role in the world. So I think with the Spanish-American War, as we enter 1900, we start to see that. We start to see this more especially in the articles in proceedings. We see articles assessing battle damage and effectiveness of platforms and technologies during the Spanish-American War. We start to see additional articles, especially once the Russo-Japanese War happens, because now we have two wars in a very short period of time that fulfill the Mahanian theories of the great naval battles. the Battle of Tsushima is instrumental in this new generation learning about how warfare is conducted. In fact, Lloyd Chandler, in his valedictory address, says that their constant study and research at the Naval Academy are necessary for advancement in any profession, especially the art and science of warfare on the sea. I think that's very important because warfare is not only this is the debate of 2015. This is the debate of humanities versus STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math courses. It has to be a combination of the two. So I think with regard to those two major battles in those two relatively short wars, the Spanish-American War and the Russo-Japanese War, we see that. We also see them reflecting on the small wars. We see them reflecting on the Philippine insurrection. We see them discussing the Boxer Rebellion. So there's a real new internationalist approach from these writers for Naval Institute proceedings. And we also see this reflective in international authors. We start to see Italian officers writing for proceedings as well. So it's not only the United States studying foreign wars and foreign ships and operations. You now have other officers. We have articles that are translating, for example, Admiral Stepan Makarov's assessment of operations during the Spanish-American War. And of course, he was killed during the Russo-Japanese War. So we start to see more and more translations of what the international officers are thinking about as well.
Craig and I talked a bit about somebody who was, in many ways, that first decade of the 1900s, a giant as a writer, as a politician, and almost as an icon of that generation. And of course, we're talking about Teddy Roosevelt. What do you see as the impact that he had on our Navy during that period and the legacy that he left?
In every generation where you see junior officers combining their efforts, trying to think through issues, it's not enough to be a collective of junior officers. What you need is that one mentor, that sea daddy, if you will, somebody who is willing to listen to their ideas and foster them, and if they are good ideas, to advance them. We saw that with the Naval Lyceum in the 1830s when you had people like Commodore John Rogers and future Commodore Matthew Perry advancing the work of the junior officers of that period. Teddy Roosevelt, I think, serves a very important function in that he is now the conduit for a number of these junior officers, the insurgents, like especially with Sims, who Commander B.J. Armstrong has written and spoken extensively about the role of William Sims during this era, particularly with his relationship to Roosevelt, a relationship that had been established prior to Roosevelt's presidency. So I think that's another important aspect, is that Roosevelt didn't jump into the presidency and when he became president. That's not when he started to study and learn about the Navy. He had been a student. He had written about the Navy during the War of 1812. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He had corresponded with a lot of these officers. And you start to see this reflective in generating new ideas. In 1905 and 06, you have Alfred Thayer Mahan and William Sims writing pieces on the all-big-gun battleship. And their influence extends well beyond the pages of proceedings. These are entered into the Senate, the record of the United States Senate. They're reprinted throughout the United States in newspapers and magazines. And you have, as part of that, people like I mentioned Homer Poundstone, and here he and others like Alger are looking at the big gun battleships as well as Asa Walker. These in the wake of the Dreadnought.
One of the central happenings of this decade, Claude, was, of course, the round-the-world cruise of the Great White Fleet. Those that are really interested in that deployment and what it represented for our Navy, what are those things they might discover at the Naval Academy Museum?
Well, we do have a number of items in the permanent exhibit on the first deck of the Naval Academy Museum. It includes a couple of models of ships that had been part of the Great White Fleet, as well as some items that had been given by foreign dignitaries as they made their way around the globe. With regard to the Warrior Writer exhibit, We do have one sketch by Henry Roederdahl, probably the best-known naval artist of that era. Roederdahl was Swedish-born. He was given a commission in the Navy Reserve and served with the Great White Fleet for part of it. He left prior to transiting the Pacific Ocean. But Roosevelt, here we again, you asked about Roosevelt earlier, he is the one who selects this artist to join them and to document this incredible journey. The sketch we have is of Admiral Edward Taussig, the first of several generations serving in the United States Navy, and I think it's one of the better sketches around. We have a number of other items of that era as well for this exhibit. That includes the 1904 Prize Essay Medal that was given to Philip Rounsville Alger for his article in Proceedings. For Homer Poundstone, we have a letter about the USS Possible. Homer Poundstone had conceptualized a number of all big gun ships for the Navy, all about 17 to 19,000 tons. And this article discusses the sketch that's attached to it, armaments and battery arrangements of a proposed ship. In fact, it's with this article that he proposes a cage mast, which becomes a very standard feature for several decades aboard battleships. We also have the valedictory address of Lloyd Chandler when he was Commandant of Midshipmen.
And with that, Claude, we wind up the first decade of the 1900s. And I really look forward to our next conversation where we will touch on a very, very important decade, and that would be the decade of World War I.
Thank you.